Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Spring is my favorite time to start a new workout routine. With the weather warming up, it feels easier to get into the rhythm of things. Whether you have 20 minutes or an hour for a Pilates class or outdoor guided walk, Peloton has everything you need to help you get going. Get a head start on summer with Peloton at onepeloton.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Welcome back to the Leaving Eden podcast. We are here with you, your hosts. My name's Gavi, as always. My BFF and co-host, cult expert, cult survivor, Sadie Carpenter, is here with you today. How are you doing today, Sadie?
I am doing so well. This is something that I've had on my to-do list literally since the inception of our podcast, and I have never felt prepared to do it. And I still don't, but I feel a little more prepared to tackle this topic in a series of episodes and see what we find out.
You know, I wish I'd been ready to do this earlier. In fact, I wish we'd all been ready to do this earlier. That's right. We're doing the big one, the rapture, the book of Revelations, the end times. This is going to be a many, many, many part series of episodes coming at you right here, right direct from the streets of gold behind the gates of pearl in heaven itself, coming straight down to you. No, just kidding. That's not where we are. We haven't been raptured just yet.
Buddy, I don't know if you know this, but you're not getting raptured.
I'm not getting raptured. It's true, because I have not accepted Jesus Christ as my Lord and Savior.
You can technically maybe be part of the 144,000 if you want.
I thought that, well, I'm part of one of the 12 tribes of Israel, so, you know, why shouldn't I be? So, anyway, that's what we've got coming in today and over the next several weeks. I think what we're going to do is we're going to alternate episodes between doing these ones and then doing some episodes, and we're going to maybe bring some guests on, talk about some other stuff, just because we know that Rapture content and Revelations content is triggering for a lot of people, and so we don't want to just like put them all together in a block. We want to be able to like do an episode, and then we want to do like a breather episode if you need like an extra week to recover from that.
Yeah, I think that's going to be the best way that we can take care of our listeners while we're doing this really tough topic. And as always, we'll give you abundant trigger warnings about what in particular we're covering in each episode. I know this is kind of the big one for a lot of people, and I'll be as careful as I can. That being said, if you just can't listen to that kind of content, that is okay. Stream the episode on mute, or don't stream it, or skip it. Go back and listen to an old episode that was not so triggering. Please, please take care of yourself, because I can only do so much to take care of you.
That being said, we are really going to try to go in and take down the what it says in the book of Revelations, what it says in the Bible, and really deconstruct it, this stuff, look at it critically, and maybe if you do have some rapture anxiety, it might be helpful for you. That's kind of the aim that we're coming at this series with.
Yeah, I certainly hope it'll be helpful to people.
Yeah, and kind of demystifying it, that might be a lot of fun. But before we get into that, the Leaving Eden podcast is the podcast about my BFF and co-host, cult expert, cult survivor, Sadie Carpenter's life in and escape from the Independent Fundamental Baptist cult, also known as the IFB, the cult in which she was raised. We talk about this cult, we talk about other cults, we talk about religion, we talk about fundamentalism, we talk about the real and present threat that cults and cult ideologies pose to society as a whole, and it is our goal to promote freedom of mind, freedom of thought, and freedom of religion. So if you like our show, if you are a fan of our show, then there's a number of things that you can do in order to support us. You can join our Patreon, where there is going to be an extended, uncensored, ad-free version of today's episode, as well as other episodes. So if you want that bonus content, we got that bonus content. It's right up there on our Patreon, patreon.com/leavingedenpodcast. You can join our Facebook group and our subreddit. Both of those places are good places to talk about just, you know, whatever religious topic, cult topic, deconstruction topic that you want to talk about. It can be light, it can be heavy. We can just share memes, you know, posts that we saw that we thought were funny. And then there's also, you know, serious deconstruction talk in there. People tend to be pretty respectful, which I like. Not a lot of online places where you get people actually treating each other with respect.
Yeah, when it's unusual, oh, we had a fight in the Facebook group today. That almost never happens.
No, it's very rare. It's like once a month or something like that. So it's, but people generally tend to be respectful there. We have a subreddit, which is also called Eden Exodus. Facebook group and subreddit are both called Eden Exodus. You can also help us by just sharing the show with your friends, your family, your coworkers, your friends, your enemies, anyone who you think might enjoy it or get something out of it. Yeah, I think without further ado, it's time to thank the patrons. Thank you to everyone who subscribes to us on Patreon. But a big special extra bonus thank you to our I Gave It All to Your patrons. Your names are I'm Not 1010. Maybe you're 1111. Maybe you're 99. Maybe you're 1212. But you're not 1010. You're certainly not 1010. Kathleen Moncrief. Melissa Manown. It still says Melissa Mosley on here, but we know that you're married now, Melissa. And Mazel Tov on Bobby, your...
That sounds like we've been stalking Melissa. We know because Melissa sent us an email.
We know because Melissa sent us an email. Thank you, Melissa. You're cool, and congratulations on getting married recently. We believe in you. We support the institution of marriage here on this podcast for everybody.
For everybody who wants it?
For maybe? Everyone who wants it. Okay. Yeah, no forced marriages. That's not what we do here.
Read the patrons.
Melora King and Todd Dale on behalf of his lovely deconstructorine ex of a partner, Madeline Antrim. Thank you guys so much for subscribing at the Faith Promise Missions tier level. I mean, at the I Gave It All tier level. And our Faith Promise Missions tier patrons, your names are Alex P., Allie Allen, Autumn of Our Discontent, Brittany, Krissa Walker, Dora J., Eleanor Donahue, Hannah Ross, Hannah Montana, Hope Norum, Horton Here's a Shane, Janine Collin, Jana Connor, Jen Kaharski, Jessica Tambo, Jonna, Junie B. Jones, and the B stands for Back of My Bullshit, Kat Henwood, K. Turwee, Kristen Marie, Learned Vixen, Linda Morgan, Madeline Antrim, Madeline Cusick, Madison Green. Is that a new one? I think that's a new one.
Oh, welcome, welcome.
Marlena Stuve, Mary Martin, Megan Arndt, Morgan, Rob the Methodist, Stephanie Johnson, Steve and Amy, Susie, Tara McNamara, and as always, Wes the Cowboy. Thank you guys so much for tuning in. I mean, for subscribing to our Faith Promise Missions tier of our Patreon. We love you guys so much.
Yes, thank you so much. And on this episode, we have a special Faith Promise Missions tier shout out to Fiona, who asked her mother if she could send us her birthday money to get her name read on the podcast. And I said, no, I'll read your name on the podcast. Thank you for being a fan, Fiona.
Children, save your money for things that are other than podcast Patreon subscriptions. like, I would feel weird if somebody was like, hey, can I join your Patreon with my birthday money? I'm a teenager or something. That's it's too much for me. Spend it on drunk elephant skincare.
Oh.
No, I'm joking. Don't do that.
Anyway, thank you to our I Gave It All tier and Faith Promise Missions tier patrons, to everybody who supports us financially over on Patreon, to people who support us in non-financial ways, like subscribing on your favorite podcast player, following us on social media, being active and positive contributor in our social media groups, sharing us with friends and family in real life. All of those things are a huge part of why we have a platform and why we have the podcast that we do today. And I'm thankful every single day. Thank you.
I feel like we're on NPR Pledge Week.
We are forever on NPR Pledge
Week. Forever we're on NPR Pledge Week. Sadie, will you hit us with the TW, the long extended revelations length TW?
In general, we talk about a lot of potentially triggering topics on this show, including but not limited to suicide and mental health, racism, misogyny, PTSD and PTSD symptoms, child abuse, mental, physical, and sexual abuse, and spiritual abuse, including guilt, shame, and fear. In most episodes, we'll mention at least a few of these topics. We try to avoid graphic detail unless it's relevant to the story that we're telling, and we do our best to give the audience a heads up if we do feel like we need to go into detail on any of these topics or anything else that we know can be triggering to listeners. This episode and the further episodes in this series are about the Book of Revelation, end times prophecies, the rapture, all of that sort of thing. On this first episode, we're going to be sticking pretty close to what the text says without doing a lot of interpretation. In future episodes, we're going to discuss the IFB interpretation, and then we're going to do some deconstructing the Book of Revelation, which I'm really looking forward to. The whole episode will be about rapture, revelation, and end times. And there will be some gory details in just what is in the text on this particular episode.
In today's episode, like Sadie said, we're starting our series about the Book of Revelation, the rapture, end times, all the different interpretations of this book, its origins, and the place that it holds in the Christian canon, and how different Christian groups see this book. And over the course of doing this podcast, it's been almost 4 years. Since I think we recorded the first episode in like May of 2020, and right now it's April of 2024. So it's been almost 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
Over the course of doing this podcast, I have read the entirety of the Bible, except for Revelation, because I had been saving Revelation to do a special episode on. Of course, if you're fundy, you'd probably say that I haven't read the Bible at all because I haven't read it in a King James Version.
What versions have you been reading? Just out of curiosity.
The version that I use for the Hebrew Bible is the JPS Tanakh, which is the Jewish Publication Society. That's the version that I use whenever I'm looking at like Hebrew Bible stuff or, as Christians call it, the Old Testament, that kind of stuff. But when it came to New Testament stuff, I was mostly using the NIV because I found the language much easier to understand. When we went into Revelation, I was asking Sadie, what version should I look at it in King James? And she was like, well, you should look at it King James and then use either. Were you saying the RSV, the NIV, a couple of other ones that you recommended to me, mm-hmm. that you were like, these are ones that you could use for reference?
Yeah, the versions that I recommend will be different depending on what I'm what passages I'm expecting you're going to read in them. If somebody's going to read the Book of Psalms, I'm going to send them straight to King James because the poetry is really beautiful. Same with Song of Solomon. If you're going to read poetry books, just go to King James. It's pretty. If you're reading anything in the New Testament that is not about gender issues in the church, go to ESV. If you're reading anything in the New Testament that is about gender issues in the church, read anything but the ESV. particularly I like RSV and NIV for New Testament. I haven't really settled on a favorite translation for Old Testament yet, but we're not doing that today, so it doesn't matter.
I did, for what it's worth, when I started reading through this book of the Bible, I started trying to read it in King James, and I just found it to be too like King Jamesy, and I was trying to just understand the meaning of the text, not, you know, get into doing Bible numerology and Bible math off of it. So it didn't really matter as much that I wasn't reading the King James, I think.
So you read What for this series?
For this series, I read Revelation.
Right. What version? What translation?
Oh, I read the NIV.
Okay. You NIV. May have said that and I may have missed it. I read for this episode, I read Revelation on BibleGateway.com with side-by-side King James and ESV. So that was what I chose for this episode. I have almost no sources. I just read the text and wrote down what it said in the simplest way that I possibly could. And I'll make little notes and explanations about the interpretations that are common, but I'm not going to get into the weeds on interpretation. We're going to level set by talking about what is in the text.
So Revelation, for those who don't know, Revelation is the last book in the New Testament. It is a work of apocalyptic literature. It is like the seminal work of apocalyptic literature, I think. Revelation tells of a coming doomsday, a return of Jesus to earth, a coming battle between the forces of good and the forces of evil, all of the classic tropes. And while it is not the first work of apocalyptic literature, it is probably the most famous, the most legendary work of apocalyptic literature. However, the first ever work of apocalyptic literature is widely regarded to be a different book of the Bible. And I would like to talk about that book, the origins of the genre itself, and the events that spawned its creation, because I think they're relevant to talking about the book of Revelation. Okay. So can I do that?
Sure thing.
According to the biblical narrative, about 3,000 years ago, the 10th century BC, King Solomon had a temple constructed in Jerusalem. This temple is known as Solomon's Temple, also known as the First Temple. It was the holiest place on earth for the Israelites. It was constructed on Mount Moriah, where the patriarch Abraham had built the altar on which he was going to sacrifice his son Isaac. And so this is the spot where God sent the angel down to stay his hand. And this is the spot where Abraham entered into the binding covenant. Within this temple, there was the Holy of Holies, which was a windowless room that could only be entered once a year by the high priest, once a year on Yom Kippur by the high priest. And in this windowless room was kept the Ark of the Covenant. So in the 6th century BC, the Babylonians conquered the kingdom of Judah, besieged Jerusalem, destroyed Solomon's temple, and captured and took many Judeans back with them to Babylon. This period is known as the Babylonian exile or the Babylonian captivity. By the way, the Babylonian captivity, the first temple destruction, are actually known historical events that have been corroborated through archaeology, as opposed to events like the Exodus, which are only part of the biblical narrative and don't have large amounts of archaeological findings that back them up as okay, real things.
Hold up. I was told that archaeologists found like a bunch of Egyptian chariots on the bottom of the Red Sea from when God parted it and the Israelites escaped through the waters and the Pharaoh tried to chase them down. Is that not accurate?
I'm going to add that to our list of is that a hoax thing that we can research. Thank you, last week's episode. I think people had fun with that. Let's see.
Yeah, I was told that there was like a ton of Egyptian chariots and horses and soldiers from the right era found on the bottom of the Red Sea. Then again, I was also told that Nessie was proof of creationism, so...
Well, you have to wonder how they would have found those chariots. Did they like use the same submersible that they sent down to like look at the Titanic? Are we gonna have like the Christian version of the Ocean Gate thing where they're building a Red Sea submarine to go down and
I mean we do have the- we there are Christians who hike all over the place looking for the Ark.
That's true. I watched a lot of Kent Hovind talking about that. No, I have added chariots to the bottom of the Red Sea to our list of potential episode topics. It's like 400 topics long, so maybe we'll get to that. The Babylonian exile is largely recounted in the Book of Daniel, which is one of the final books of the Hebrew Bible. The Book of Daniel is widely regarded to be the first example of apocalyptic literature. So in this book, Daniel, in Babylon, like Joseph in Egypt, is able to interpret the dreams of the king and curry favor. Daniel continues to also have prophetic dreams, including dreams that Christians interpret to foretell the coming of Jesus. He receives visions regarding an end to the exile, other prophecies regarding God uplifting the people of Israel once again, and a new temple being built after 70 years. And sure enough, King Cyrus ends the exile, and the people are allowed to return to Judea. And they build another temple, which is colloquially referred to as the Second Temple. The Book of Daniel is seen by many Christians as a sort of sister book to the Book of Revelation because of the similarities between them. Both contain prophetic visions of the future of the world, but also timing of their writing is important. So Revelation, which is English for the Greek word apocalypse, was written somewhere between like around 95-96 CE, about 63 years after the death of Jesus and about 25 years after the destruction of the Second Temple, which occurred in 70 CE, when the Roman armies besieged Jerusalem, just like the Babylonians did, destroyed the temple, just like the Babylonians did, and took the Judean people back to Europe as slaves, just like the Babylonians took the Judean people, the Israelites, back to Babylon as slaves. Fun fact, the 60,000 Judeans taken as slaves by the Romans not only provided the slave labor used to build the Roman Colosseum, but also became the ancestors of most of the Jewish community that developed in Europe over the last 2,000 years. So, yay for that. Not yay for that. That's not a good thing. Slavery isn't good.
I was just waiting for you to get to the end of that thought.
Yeah, that's not a fun fact. I'm sorry.
Yeah, but at this point, I don't need to interrupt you because I know your brain will catch up.
Yeah.
I just take a pause and wait.
I think that it is important to note that these similarities are there because this idea of an end to the world that is prophesized about in the Book of Daniel, as well as an idea of the end of the world that is prophesized about in the Book of Revelation, is something that I at least see coming as a direct response to the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem, which to the Judean people of the day would have truly seemed like the end of the world. So while the death of Jesus clearly had an effect on the author, I think that the author was... because it was 60-something years after the death of Jesus, it's possible that the author was not old enough to have been alive at the same time as Jesus, but it is also very possible that the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem could have had just as big effect on the book's author.
The other thing regarding the destruction of the Second Temple is this was prophesied in the Olivet Discourse. So in the Gospels, there are, Matthew 24 and 25, Mark 13, and Luke 21. Jesus gives a prophecy about the end of the world and the kingdom of God coming. He kind of starts it out by referencing, do you see this temple? He points to the temple. Yes, we see the temple. Well, this temple will be destroyed, but I could destroy it and rebuild it in 3 days. So that scene is a prophecy about the temple of Jesus himself being crucified and dying and then resurrected in 3 days. But it's also seen as a prophecy about the destruction of the Second Temple. And Jesus ties that event to the end of the world.
That's going to be important for later.
Yes. So if the John... that wrote Revelation is the John that I tend to think wrote Revelation, he would have been there for that.
Speaking of John, the author of Revelation, known by many as John of Patmos because he resided on the island of Patmos when he wrote this book.
So scholars disagree on the details of exactly who this John was. Many early scholars and early theologians thought it was John the Beloved, the same John who wrote the Gospel of John. The thing is, there are a lot of guys named John around at the time, and scholars definitely do not all agree that John the Beloved was the writer, but that was the tradition that I was always taught.
That would make... John would be pretty old at the time of writing that, if that was true then.
Right. He would have been
probably be in his 80s,
possibly in his 80s or 90s. So this book of Revelation can pretty reliably be traced to being written during the time of the Roman Emperor Domitian, which was from the years 81 to 96 CE. So that is in the right timeline for a very old John the Beloved to also be John the Revelator.
So in order for that John to have written this book, and due to its contents containing seven letters for seven different churches, John would have had to have been somebody who was known in the church by a lot of people, who would have been in regular correspondence with these churches, and also the fact that John was somebody who could read and write in Greek, because this book was written in Koine Greek, and it means that he was probably somebody who was well-educated and not just some rando named John who lived on an island and who was out here, like, writing letters to churches.
You didn't look up how he ended up on the island, did you?
No, I didn't. I expected you would tell me that.
Yeah, so according to church tradition from very early Christian historian Tertullian, John the Beloved continued as an evangelist after Jesus' death, preaching to many, many people. Eventually, he got in trouble with the Roman government over it, as did St. Paul and many other church fathers, and the Roman government sentenced him to death by boiling in hot oil.
Oof.
However, God miraculously saved him and didn't let him die being boiled in oil, according to church tradition. And the Romans wouldn't execute him twice for the same crime because the Romans are more merciful than the state of Alabama. So he was exiled to Patmos, which, think Australia. It was an exile colony.
I mean, I guess last week we had the patron saint of leather makers being a guy who was flayed alive, and now we have John of Patmos being boiled in oil. So maybe he's the patron saint of fry cooks.
Oh, God.
If you work it.
So Patmos, where Revelation purports to be written, is a small rocky island. Patmos is a small rocky island, and there is outside evidence that it was used as a place to banish people during the reign of Emperor Domitian. After the death of Domitian, the exiles that he put into place would no longer be exiled because your term of exile was until the emperor dies. So According to tradition, after Domitian died, John was allowed to leave, and he went back home to Ephesus and died there.
I mean, for obvious reasons, I think, like, the boiling in oil reason. I personally doubt that this guy and the other John are the same guy. But that's just me.
Well, the story is that God saved him.
But my thought is, like, would you want to survive being boiled in oil?
Probably not, but that's part of the traditional story is, oh, he suffered for God.
I mean, I don't know, even if they just, like, dunk you in a little bit and then take you out, you're still gonna have, like, skin peeling, blistering infection. You're not gonna survive that.
Yeah, I mean, I have heard theories that, you know, how people can walk over hot coals because there's just a tiny bit of dew or dampness on their feet, and that water boils and turns into steam and prevents their feet from actually touching the coals. Have you ever heard that one?
So maybe he was, like, really sweaty when they dunked him in.
Exactly. So there could, hypothetically, be a scientific reason. It's pretty unlikely, but it could happen.
So question, is this story in the Bible, or is this one of those stories that's like, oh, this is held in Christian tradition?
I thought it was in the Bible until a couple days ago, when I was doing research for this episode, and then I found out it is not in the Bible. It is actually from Tertullian. I spent my entire life under the impression that it was in the Bible, but actually no, which is so weird that the fundies accept and continue to tell this story because, like, sola scriptura and all of that.
I mean, we have that too in Judaism, because we have the Torah and we have the Talmud, and then we have the Midrash, and the Midrash has all sorts of, like, notations in it that, I'm trying to think of some of the weird ones. I put a post on the internet asking people what their favorite ones were, and this one guy who was, like, a Hasidic Jew responded to me and said, we call them Midrash from Mars. But he told, but there are, like, all sorts of ones in there. Like, one of them was, on Noah's Ark, the raven was lusting after Noah's wife, which is...
What?
There's... that is a real one, I do believe. There's this guy named Og that shows up in the Book of Numbers that apparently survived the flood of Noah and was just around hundreds or thousands or whatever of years later, and he was the king of the Amorites for all that time, and he survived by like holding on to the side of the boat.
What?
Also, in the story of Purim, Vashti didn't want to heed her husband's wishes at the beginning of the book because she had grown a tail and she was embarrassed by it.
Oh my God.
Yeah, see, like, it's things like that. They're like, well, this changes everything.
Wow. I mean, we need to do an episode on Vashti in general.
Yeah, that would be interesting.
That's that might be the next, like, deconstructing the Bible story one we need to do. Wow. What's really funny to me is that the IFB will talk about stuff like that from the pulpit and say, oh, and this is why Jews aren't going to heaven, because they focus on all these extra parts that aren't in the Bible and they missed the Messiah, whatever. Please excuse me. I know that's highly offensive.
Oh, it's fine.
But I feel like I need to make a disclaimer. I don't want to hurt anybody's feelings.
No, it's okay.
Like, the IFB will criticize Judaism and other religions for doing that, and then they will also still do it. Because they criticize Catholicism for focusing on church history and bringing tradition in as another source of understanding outside of scripture. But this was taught to me as a literal part of the story, and it is Catholic church tradition. It is not part of the scripture. Ah, we're going to get more into that, and we're going to revisit who wrote Revelation and the historical provenance around the texts later on in the series. Because today I want to dig in and cover just the skeleton of what is in the text. So I want to read a couple verses from the first chapter. I'm reading in ESV, trying to avoid reading in King James, just because I don't want to double trigger the people who are already triggered.
Yeah, you're going to trigger hella people if you read in King James.
So this is chapter 1, verse 1 and 2. The revelation of Jesus Christ, which God gave him to show to his servants the things that must soon take place. He made it known by sending his angel to his servant John, who bore witness to the word of God and to the testimony of Jesus Christ, even to all that he saw. So that verse is also what makes people think that John the Beloved is also John the Revelator. John, who bore witness to the word of God. That is John chapter 1. In the beginning was the word, and the word was with God, and the word was God. The same was in the beginning with God. All things were made by him, and so on and so forth. And to the testimony of Jesus Christ. So if you take that conjunctive prepositional phrase, and to the testimony of Jesus Christ. Oh, that's two prepositional phrases. Anyway, if you apply those to bore witness to as the verb, then it is saying that John bore witness to the testimony of Jesus Christ, which would mean that likely John the Beloved would be the identified John. That was way off the rails. My grammar nerd people love me and everybody else hates me now.
Hey, I criticize you for getting a lot of fun out of diagramming sentences, and now here I am eating crow.
Learning that it's useful.
Learning that it's useful.
It's extremely useful for Bible. That's why they made us do it so much in Christian schools. So John, moving on to verse 9 through 11a. I, John, your brother and partner in tribulation and the kingdom and the patient endurance that are in Jesus, was on the island called Patmos on account of the word of God and the testimony of Jesus. I was in the Spirit on the Lord's day, and I heard behind me a loud voice like a trumpet saying, write what you see in a book and send it to the seven churches. So the book starts with this proclamation. So it's, this is John. I'm John. This is what I was doing on Patmos. And then there's a proclamation from a character who most people interpret to be Jesus. This character commands John to write all of this in a book and send it to the seven churches. This character, who most people think is Jesus, says, fear not, I am the first and the last and the living one. I died, and behold, I am alive forevermore, and I have the keys of death and Hades. Write therefore the things that you have Write therefore the things that you have seen, those that are and those that are to take place after this. The little phrase, I died and behold, I am alive forevermore. That's what most people point to and say, oh, this is Jesus.
I read this and it seemed pretty clear to me that this is Jesus.
Sure. Earlier in the chapter, when I was reading like verse 1 and 2, the revelation of Jesus Christ, he made it known by sending his angel to his servant John. So the question is, what does that word angel mean? The angel of Jesus. Does that mean an archangel who works for him? Or does that mean Jesus sent part of his spirit out to meet in person with John? This is getting into the weeds. I'm going to try to keep moving. It's kind of a harbinger for the rest of the book that Jesus is mentioned in the first part of the first chapter. But by the second part of the first chapter, there's this character introduced who is probably Jesus or part of Jesus, but it's not clear and he isn't given a name. That's going to continue. First, we get messages to 7 early Christian churches. Most of these 7 churches get both a message of praise or positivity, as well as a warning about something they need to do better, as well as a promise for what will be given to those from that church who are faithful, who do a good job.
If you've spent any time in the corporate world, this is what's known as a compliment sandwich.
It is the sandwich method. Yes, it is.
Jesus invented it. Once again, capitalist Jesus, Robert Kiyosaki Jesus, strikes again.
Capitalist Jesus says, if you're faithful to the end and endure the tribulation, I will give you a pizza party.
Can I have PTO from soul winning? No.
So I think I'm going to bore people if I go through every one of the 7 letters to the 7 churches, although I certainly heard it plenty in church growing up. So I'm going to do samples.
Yeah, this is the part where we get the synagogue of Satan. We get the Jews who are not Jews talk. It's very critical in the replacement theology that is favored by those of Steven Anderson's ilk.
Yeah. And I came from a church and a movement that analyzed every word of Revelation. It turns out, except for the ones that they didn't want to deal with, like that passage. Because we were told, oh, those are just they're false prophets or something.
I mean, that would make sense, though, having read that.
Right. So just to give a sample of what these messages were like, the church at Ephesus was praised for rooting out false prophets and for standing against the Nicolaitans, who were definitely a real sect of early Christianity that were considered heretical. The historical record is not 100% clear why everybody hated the Nicolaitans so much. One theory is that they were having orgies for Jesus.
Damn.
So Jack Scott might have been a Nicolaitan.
Disco Jesus, amyl nitrate poppers Jesus, MDMA Jesus.
Okay, so but if they're let's take this at face value and so let's read into this as scripture for a second. It would make total sense that people who were like orgies for Jesus and that's how you get saved. It would make sense that they were making some people mad. So it is a pretty valid, it's a theory that tracks for me, especially because this is taking place in the Greek and Roman empires, where that would have been, like, orgies for gods is something that the other people do, and that's something we as Christians do not do. So it does historically make sense. It's not just all flash and scandal that's what people think was going on in Nicolaitan's group. Ephesus was told, you're doing a good job, you're rooting out false prophets, but you've left your first love. Usually this is interpreted as you've lost some of the passion with which you were living the Christian life, and you're encouraged to go find that passion again. In contrast, the church at Laodicea gets no praise at all. They are called lukewarm. So I'm going back to King James for this quote, because this is definitely one that was used for control in the IFB. Verse 15 and 16, I know thy works, that thou art neither cold nor hot. I would thou wert cold or hot. So then because thou art lukewarm and neither cold nor hot, I will spew thee out of my mouth. The letters to the churches are a common preaching topic in the IFB, but the specific messages to Ephesus and Laodicea come up pretty commonly. Well, let's say the pastor wants to preach against you know, infant baptism or other versions that are not the King James or women wearing pants, they can compare any of those things to the Nicolaitans, because we don't know what the Nicolaitans were actually up to. So this verse is very useful to twist into, like, stand up against whoever I don't like. And the verse about you've left your first love, as well as the verse about being lukewarm, are really common, because the IFB interpretation is, if you don't care enough about sin, you are disgusting to God. Or even if you're doing good things for God, but you're not doing them for the right reasons. If you're doing good things, but you're not hot for God, on fire, passionate about God, then you're disgusting to God. A lot of IFB theology and teaching goes right back to, you're disgusting to God. And it is a real bad foundation for any kind of self-esteem.
So the IFB are criticizing each other in the way that you would if you were a Bachelor contestant trying to cast aspersions on your competitor.
Yes, you're here for the wrong reasons.
So at this point, this is when Jesus decides to show John a vision of heaven, which contains a throne for God, Jesus? I don't know. Who's on that throne? We don't know. We don't see. But he's surrounded by 24 elders in thrones, as well as various animals and, you know, with seven eyes, angels that look like birds that are covered in eyes. A lot of eyes going on here.
Indeed. They're living creatures. I don't know if I'm going to even try to interpret that. So starting in chapter 4, yes, this is the introduction to all of the end times stuff, the prophecy of what is to come. I think it's super important to note that the first couple of verses in chapter 4 are sometimes interpreted to be about the rapture. I think this is a really wonky interpretation, and removing these verses from the context of the rapture takes like half of the scriptural support for the rapture and like 90% of the scriptural support for a pre-tribulation rapture away. But that's just my opinion. Here's the verses. From chapter 4, after this I looked, and behold, a door standing open in heaven. And the first voice, which I had heard speaking to me like a trumpet, said, come up here, and I will show you what must take place after this. At once I was in the spirit, and behold, a throne stood in heaven with one seated on the throne. In King James, that phrase, come up here, is rendered as come up hither. And that is used in a ton of media songs about the rapture. The connotation of the trumpet is used in other verses that may or may not be about the rapture. But as you'll see, there are trumpets going on through most of the Revelation narrative, and I think that's shaky evidence. I don't think, oh, there's a trumpet, that means the rapture. I don't think that works. Personally, I don't think Revelation 4, 1, and 2 are in any way about the rapture. I literally think it's just John's introduction into the apocalyptic part of this vision. And so much of pre-trib, premillennial futurism, the belief that Revelation is an actual prophecy about stuff that has not happened yet, and all Christians are going to be raptured before the tribulation. And then we have rapture, tribulation, Armageddon, millennium, last battle, forever with God. So much of that is based on this verse needing to be about the rapture. And I think that's just terrible evidence. But after, yeah, we're coming back to that. After these verses, there's this very rich and vivid description of the throne room of God. There are these otherworldly creatures around it. There are songs of praise for God, 24 elders who sit around the throne. I think we should go take up the offering and come back talking about Revelation, starting with chapter 5, and get into the narrative there.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey
Hey, Sadie here. If this is your first time listening to the Leaving Eden podcast, make sure you go back and check out episode 57. It's a primer episode for new listeners. That episode tells my personal story and gives you all the terms and information that you'll need to know going forward. Also, check out our cult true crime series, The First Family of Fundamentalism, so that you can get the whole cult story. If you like our show, you can support us by joining our Patreon, where we have extended and uncensored episodes, as well as other bonus content available. You can also join in the discussion in our Facebook group. That group is called Eden Exodus. Tell a friend, tell a family member, tell your worst enemy. The Leaving Eden podcast is a fully independent podcast, and we really appreciate your support. Now, back to the show.
We are back from our break. We are talking about this book of Revelation, the last book in the Bible. And now is when we really start cooking with gas. We're hearing the trumpets. Although when I hear the, like, heaven trumpets, I think of like the Sunday night football theme. I hear like ba da da ba da da ba da da ba da da ba 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 da bum ba da bum ba da bum ba ba. Is that what heaven sounds like?
I hope so.
Sunday night football in heaven. Is that Sunday night football or is that Monday night football? I can't remember. Yeah. Or it could be bum 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 bum.
I don't know, but there's no time in heaven, so. Does all football all the time.
But if there's no time in heaven, then how do they play football?
That's a real good question.
They can, if there's no time in
hit
heaven,
the Ouija
then you
board.
Can't,
we need to ask my dad that one.
I mean, if you get like raptured up into heaven, we'll get to that later. So Jesus comes to John and gives him a vision of heaven. And in heaven, Jesus is holding a scroll. This scroll is very important because it's got seven seals on it. And by seals, we're talking about like a wax seal that's used for sealing letters, right? We're not yes. talking about the animal no. seal. Okay. The angels in heaven tell John that he would not be able to open the seals. And even if he could, he would not be able to read what was written on the scroll anyway.
Jesus is holding a scroll with seals, and the Son of Man, who meets John back in chapter one, who was dead and now is alive forevermore, is with John. And then there's somebody sitting on the throne holding a scroll, not positively identified as Jesus or the Son of Man character. So maybe that's God. And then the elders say, the Lion of the tribe of Judah, the Root of David, has conquered. And a lamb appears with seven horns and seven eyes. And the lamb takes the scroll from the guy on the throne and starts opening the seals. So Jesus is the lamb. So I don't know who that is that's standing next to John or sitting on the throne.
So you're saying that the Son of Man, who was predicted in the book of Daniel, and Jesus are not the same person?
It gets really confusing because I'm going to get to the part about the woman with child and the dragon who's trying to eat her baby. And that also kind of makes it seem like the Son of Man is not Jesus. The typical IFB interpretation is that there are multiple versions of Jesus. Jesus is kind of everywhere.
I mean, if he's got magic powers, then that makes perfect sense that he would be able to do that. So
yeah, but I'll get to the other Son of Man prophecy later. Also, Jesus, famously, not the son of any man, son born of woman, not of... Anyway, who is Jesus in this passage? The Son of Man, the angel of Jesus, the guy on the throne, the lamb that was slain, who is also the root of the David and the Lion of the tribe of Judah. Ugh.
Daenerys Stormborn of the House Targaryen, first of her name, the unburnt queen of the Andals and the first men, protector of the realm, lady regent of the seven kingdoms, queen of Meereen, Khaleesi of the great grass sea, the breaker of chains and the mother of dragons and the titles, exactly. Like,
yeah. Verse 13 in chapter 5 reads, to him who sits on the throne and to the lamb be blessing and honor and glory and might forever and ever. I'm just saying him who sits on the throne and the lamb are identified as different people. And I think it's confusing. It's just a nitpick. I get frustrated because certain types of Christians are all about Revelation being 100% literal. Every word is perfect. Every word is prophecy. But there's also like a shape-shifting bilocational Jesus that nobody is dealing with in this text.
Wait, so you're saying that Jesus isn't literally a lamb and that he's not going to do songs with Sherry Lewis?
Except for in this, he's literally appearing as a lamb because it says the lamb who has seven horns and 10 eyes or seven horns and seven eyes, excuse me. The devil has seven horns and 10 heads. We'll get there. Oh, gosh. The first seal. So the scroll has seven seals on it, and the lamb is going to start opening the seals, and we see what happens when each seal is open. Okay. The first seal in chapter 6, verse 1 is opened. The first seal is the white horse ridden by a rider with a bow and a crown who went out conquering and to conquer. The second seal in chapter 6, verse 3 is a red horse. The rider of the red horse is carrying a sword and is given power to take peace away from the earth. This rider is commonly referred to as war. Of course, Mars, the god of war, commonly associated with the color red, could be a literary connection. The third seal is opened in chapter 6, verse 5. That seal unleashes a rider on a black horse. The rider has scales in his hand. This horse is often referred to as famine. The fourth seal in chapter 6, verse 7 is a pale horse. The rider is named Death, and hell followed with him. These four riders together are given authority over a quarter of the earth to kill with sword and famine and pestilence. I do want you to make a note every time we say a quarter of the earth is killed or a third of the earth dies in an earthquake or whatever, because I am going to do the math on that, obviously, before I wrap up the series.
It's pretty frequent.
It's a lot. And a quarter of the earth died, and a third of the earth died, and then a quarter of the earth died. The fifth seal is opened, and John sees the souls of martyrs under the throne. All the martyrs are given a white robe and told to wait for the rest of the martyrs that are still to come. Which, just a little nitpick, that doesn't seem like much of an event. Reading this as a grown-up was kind of wild.
How long had it been since you, like, read through this book?
How many years has it been?
Yeah.
Oh, I probably read it in my early 20s. So close to 10 years.
And you just see it way different now.
Yeah, we're going to get to all that.
So this is the first time you've like read through this book since deconstructing.
Yeah.
Man.
I've like referenced parts of it since then, but this is my first time all the way through.
We're going to get to talking about that specifically later, but that's going to be
for
fun.
Sure. Yeah. So the sixth seal is opened in verse 12. There is a great earthquake on earth. The sun temporarily goes black. The moon appears to become blood, and stars fall to the earth. Then in chapter 7, between the sixth and seventh seal, quite a few things happen. First, 144,000 Jews are sealed as the servants of God, who are going to be protected by God through the wrath to come, and they are going to be preaching and trying to get people saved before even more people die. And I'm not saying that this is evidence for predestination, but it is a little bit weird that there's exactly 12,000 from each of the 12 tribes that are going to be sealed to God. That seems a little too exact. Like, after 25% of the earth's population is wiped out, and then there's a giant earthquake? I don't know.
Well, how many people were alive at the time on Earth?
At the time?
Yeah,
ooh,
at the
that's
time.
A good question.
Because, like, if you look at Earth population, what is the Earth population at, like, the year 100 CE?
Let's do, like, 80 CE. Oh, let's see. Population Reference Bureau, PRB.org.
Because I assume they'll only have, like, an estimation.
300 million in 1 CE.
Wow, so that's fewer people than are alive in America right now.
Yes. This chapter is where we get the phrase Great Tribulation. There are all of these people pouring into heaven all the time. And John is like, where are all these people coming from? And one of the elders tells him, these are the martyrs coming out of the Great Tribulation. This is a major feature in a lot of fiction works about Revelation and end times. The idea is getting martyred for Jesus during the tribulation makes you a special kind of martyr, and you go straight to heaven. Do not pass go. Do not collect 200 years in purgatory. Do not, because there, we'll get to it when we talk about the Great White Throne Judgment, but there is reason to think that people who die during the tribulation and are not saved kind of get put on hold until the Great White Throne Judgment. But those who die during the tribulation and are saved get to go straight to heaven. I'll get back to it. The Lamb opens the seventh seal, and there's total silence in heaven for about half an hour. The seventh seal judgment is the seven trumpet judgments. So it's kind of a parenthetical thing or like outline format, depending on how you want to think about that. But the seventh seal judgment is all of the trumpet judgments, which are generally considered to be worse. I will say, from the IFB futurist, premillennial and generally pre-trib perspective, the seal judgments and the trumpet judgments are intended to be God's last warning call to get everybody saved that will possibly get saved and not be rebellious in their hearts and never get saved, said with the greatest sarcasm. The bowl judgments are then God releasing his wrath on the people who would not turn to God and get saved. So just to kind of set where we are in these judgments, we're starting up the trumpet judgments. Before the trumpet judgments even start, the angel throws fire down from the altar of God in heaven onto the earth, which brings about thunder and lightning and another earthquake. The first trumpet is blown, and hail and fire mixed with blood are thrown onto the earth. One third of the earth is burned up. One third of all trees are burned, and all green grass is burned. That seems like a bad situation for carbon dioxide.
No, that's not good.
Yeah. The second trumpet blows, something like a great mountain burning with fire is thrown into the sea, most commonly interpreted as an asteroid of some kind. A third of the sea becomes blood, and a third of living things in the sea die, and a third of ships are destroyed. The third trumpet judgment, a star commonly interpreted as an asteroid called Wormwood. Sorry, panic attack.
I thought you were laughing at the name Wormwood.
No, I got over an hour.
Woo! You know what we should do for every episode? We're going to so how long are we into this recording?
104:33.
Right now it's 104:33. Next episode we'll time it and see how long we can get into it before you get another one.
Yeah.
You taking the over or the under on 104:33 for next episode? Because next episode we're talking about like the IFB interpret, like under. We're actually talking. You'll take the under. Okay.
Yeah.
So where are we setting the over under? Are we setting it 40 minutes, 30 minutes?
I don't know how that 35? Works. So you're going to have to tell me.
The over under is like...
Why isn't the over under at 104:33?
Well, because we think it's going to be less than that because we're talking specifically about futurism.
Right. So if it's before 104, then I win. And if it's after 104, then you win, right?
Yeah, I think it's going to be less than that.
Okay.
Just because, but okay. You know what? I believe in you, but I'm not betting on you. You can bet on yourself. That's the move. Always bet on yourself.
So, the third trumpet is blown and a star called Wormwood. This is also commonly interpreted as being an asteroid hitting Earth. Wormwood falls on one third of the rivers and springs. And one third of the water in the world becomes wormwood and people die because of lack of access to clean water. For what it's worth, wormwood is a plant that has a very bitter taste. It would have been familiar to, interestingly, both early church readers of Revelation as well as to European readers for much of the last two millennia. You may be familiar with wormwood as one of the plants that flavors absinthe, which personally I just cannot get into. Wormwood is toxic in extremely high doses. In the second trumpet, a third of the sea becomes blood and a third of the living things in the sea die. And then the third trumpet, a third of rivers and springs become contaminated. Just to track how bad things are getting for the people on Earth during this hypothetical judgment. The fourth trumpet, the sun, moon, and stars are darkened by one third. It's not specific whether it's like a third of all the stars go out or every star is dimmed by 33 1/3% or what, or if the sun shines a third less time every day.
That's not going to be good for people's seasonal affective disorder.
Right. Seriously. I remember this being an event in the Left Behind series where they talked about the sun. They interpreted in that series as the sun being darker. Man, that would really suck in winter in Oregon.
That's true. Very far north.
The last three trumpets, number 5, 6, and 7, are also known as the three woes. The fifth trumpet, a star, again, falls from heaven to earth, but this star represents a person who is given the key to the bottomless pit, aka hell. And this person opens up hell, and locusts with the power of scorpions come out of the smoke of the bottomless pit and are given free rein to torment anybody who does not have God's seal on their foreheads. They can torment people for 5 months, but they can't kill anyone. These are sometimes portrayed as horse-sized locusts or sometimes as small insects shaped like horses. because of the way the description is written, whatever size they are, they work directly for the devil. And this may have been the part of the Left Behind novels that freaked me out the most.
Sadie, would you rather fight a locust the size of a horse or a swarm of horses that are the size of locusts?
I think a swarm of horses that are the size of locusts. But they have scorpion tails. Don't forget the scorpion tails.
Oh, scorpion tails. Okay.
So then we get this nice little break before the seventh trumpet. There's almost like a pageantry kind of display. An angel comes down from heaven with a little scroll in his hand. The angel puts his right foot on the sea and his left foot on the land, and then seven thunders sound. Then the voice from heaven tells John to go get the scroll from the angel. So John goes and gets the scroll. Then the angel tells him to eat the scroll. The angel says it will make your stomach bitter, but in your mouth it will be sweet as honey. So John eats the scroll, and sure enough, it tastes sweet, but it makes his stomach bitter, which I assume just means it gives him a stomachache. Really bad acid reflux. So John is given a measuring stick and told to measure the temple of God in heaven, but only the inside part of the temple and not the courtyard. Then he's told about the two witnesses, which is kind of a major big deal for people who believe that Revelation is literal and coming. This is interesting because it's not something that John sees happen, that he's just told about them, when almost everything else in the story is something that he sees play out in his vision. So he's told that there are going to be two witnesses. They will prophesy for 1260 days or 3.5 years, 42 months. They will have power to pour fire from their mouths and kill anyone who gets in their way. They will be able to bring plagues on earth, and this power lasts until they finish their prophecy. When their prophecy is ended after 3.5 years, the beast that comes from the bottomless pit will kill them, and their bodies will lie in the public street for 3.5 days. But then God will raise them from the dead very publicly, and they will ascend up into heaven.
So up at this point, basically we're doing table setting, right? So if you're trying to predict the rapture, these are the things that you're looking for.
Right.
These are like the events or the things that you're looking for, but the rapture hasn't happened yet.
Right, unless you believe that way back in chapter 4 where it says come up hither and John says I was caught up in the spirit. Unless you believe that's the rapture.
Question.
Yeah.
Having read through this book, I'm looking for where the rapture actually is, and I don't know if I've seen it directly referenced, or am I missing something?
No, you're not missing something. It's mentioned in Revelation. There is a part, and I'm not sure if I can find it on the fly. There's a part way down at the end of Revelation. Let's see if I can find it in chapter 20 or so.
What?
Let's try chapter 19. No, seriously, the rapture is not described in Revelation. There is some stuff near the end about Jesus coming, the second coming. So, okay, I'm going to back up a little bit.
Wait.
we're dealing with multiple, I'm going way off script here. We're dealing with multiple events. Okay. So the rapture is one event. Armageddon, where Jesus fights the devil and beats him forever, well, for 1,000 years, is another event. The millennium, where Jesus reigns on earth for 1,000 years while the devil's in jail, is a different event. After the millennium, there is a final battle. Jesus conquers Satan forever and throws him into the bottomless pit where he can do no more harm ever again. The futurist premillennial pre-trib view is that the events happen in the following order. The church age, the rapture, 3.5 years of tribulation, 3.5 years of great tribulation, the second coming, Armageddon, the millennium, the final battle, the marriage supper of the Lamb. Jesus is Jesus forever. Devil's gone. Woohoo.
But the rapture isn't... Wait.
Oh, you're so confused.
No, because like...
So there was this part way back in like chapter 4 where the Spirit said, come up hither. And then John says, a door was opened in heaven and I was in the Spirit and I saw these things which must be hereafter. That's it.
But that's not saying everybody who is saved and is a Christian gets zoomed up into heaven and their bodies are going to disappear on earth, but they're going to go up into heaven.
Right.
And then everybody... But
so that stuff,
where the f- does this come from then?
Thessalonians and the Olivet Discourse, not Revelation. So I told you in the Olivet Discourse, in Jesus's personal prophecy that he made in the Gospels, Jesus ties the rapture to the end of the world, to the destruction of the second temple. Like, all of these things are not necessarily happening at the exact same time, but they are all related and causational towards each other. That's not a real word. They're all related and have a cause and effect relationship on each other. Then you add in the book of Daniel, the 70 weeks prophecy, because that ties in with 7 years and 3.5 years and 1260 days and all of this stuff. You do some math. And then the only place the actual rapture is described in the Bible is in Thessalonians.
But what does it say there? Is that like saying like I was caught up in the Spirit has a much more reasonable explanation if you like it in a work of text where there's like a Holy Spirit coming down to show him a vision saying, oh, I was caught up in the Spirit. Like, it's not just the Holy Spirit saying, come here a minute, I want to show you something.
Yeah, like, that's a much more reasonable explanation of, like, come here, dude. I want to show you something. I'm going to show you stuff that's going to happen in the future. Hold on. I'm looking for Thessalonians. I have to sing this song.
Like, the guy on the throne is Jesus out of it. Or, like, the guy on the throne is God or Jesus. Or so, like, I feel like I'm really f***ing losing it. Because I've read through the whole Bible except for this book. Because I was saving this and I'm like, okay, this is the part with the rapture in it. I'm going to save that for there. And I just assumed that it was in there. But it's not f***ing in there.
Right. And I also feel like I need to inform you that actually the book of Revelation is hella mid-trib or post-trib rapture. And so is the Olivet Discourse. And I just found that out like 3 days ago. I'm like texting pastors that I know like, hey, have you noticed that the Olivet Discourse is actually hella post-trib rapture and Revelation is pretty either mid-trib or post-trib and that pre-tribulation rapture is really not in the Bible?
Well, then, okay. I mean, and I guess we'll talk about this in the coming weeks. I want to know where the pre-trib... Because, like, you could say, oh, the people getting zoomed up to heaven, the martyrs who are getting zoomed up to heaven in Revelation, you could say, oh, that's the rapture.
Right, but no, those are dead people. Those are martyrs who died, not live people who get beamed up.
It's not like, ba ba da da ba 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 ba, and then suddenly...
Right, which is exactly how it's portrayed in every bit of media about it. Okay, I found the verse... Please nobody make fun of me for not knowing where it was and for my trouble finding Thessalonians. That's incredibly embarrassing. 1 Thessalonians 4, starting with verse 13, and I'm reading King James because that's which Bible I grabbed first. But I would not have you to be ignorant, brethren, concerning them which are asleep, that ye sorrow not, even as others which have no hope. For if we believe that Jesus died and rose again, even so them also which sleep in Jesus will God bring with him. For this we say unto you, by the word of the Lord, that we which are alive and remain unto the coming of the Lord shall not prevent them which are asleep. For the Lord himself shall descend from heaven with a shout, with the voice of the archangel, and with the trump of God, and the dead in Christ shall rise first. Then we which are alive and remain shall be caught up together with them in the clouds to meet the Lord in the air, and so shall we ever be with the Lord. Wherefore comfort one another with these words. So the theological controversy in the book of Thessalonians, the people that Paul was writing to were nervous that it's like some of their church members had already died. They were under the impression that everybody who was a Christian was going to live until Jesus came back. Because Revelation says this is going to happen soon. The Olivet Discourse says this generation shall not pass away until these words be fulfilled. So everybody was of the opinion that Jesus was coming back like in the next 5 years, roughly. And when it didn't happen and people who were church members in the early church started to die, then the people who were still alive in the early church were worried, well, does my being alive mean that my family member who was a Christian and died doesn't get to go be with God? Like, do they miss out on the second coming of Jesus, which is coming anytime because he said it was going to be in like 5 years, right? So Paul is comforting them and saying, no, when Jesus comes back for his people, everybody, we which are alive and remain, shall be caught up together with them in the clouds to meet the Lord in the air, and so shall we ever be with the Lord. That is it. That is the rapture in the Bible. But he's telling people, yes, you are going to get beamed up into the sky to spend forever with Jesus, but so are your dead loved ones who died before the rapture happened. Are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. I'm just trying to comprehend this.
Like, dude, so I'm gonna slip into.
So it's in there. It's in the Bible. It's just not.
It doesn't in say Revelation. It's gonna. Right. It's not in Revelation. It is not tied to the end times, except for that Jesus coming back is also the end times. So it's all a connection, like a telephone game. Well, Jesus said the temple is going to be destroyed, and the abomination of desolation is going to happen. And then sometime after that, Jesus is going to come back. And he said, well, I don't even know the day or the time. God knows when it's going to be, but he hasn't told me yet. And then Paul says in Thessalonians, well, yes, Jesus is coming back, but he's coming back for all the living people and all the dead people. Yeah, I know that he said he was coming really soon and this generation would not pass until he came back. But maybe that was kind of metaphorical, so don't worry about it. If you die, Jesus is still going to get you. Which kind of seems like somebody who is trying to COA.
Get you to buy their cryptocurrency.
Yeah. So, oh my God. Pre-trib. So pre-tribulation rapture is not super in the Bible, and actually, having read it, post-tribulation rapture is in the Bible.
Not mid-tribulation. I mean, it could be mid-trib. I don't know.
I read a really interesting paper, actually, that mid-trib is not in the Bible. It's, like, not impossible from a biblical literalist point of view. As much as it burns me to say that Steven Anderson has a small chance of being right about something. Anyway.
We got to move on to these, what are these, the bowl judgments?
Seventh trumpet. Yeah. Should we go into the seventh trumpet, seven bowls? So that was the sixth, trumpet. And then there was a break before the second trumpet. Okay, here we go. John ate the scroll. There's going to be two witnesses. Measure the temple. We don't know when the rapture has happened because it hasn't been happened yet. possibly, unless that verse in chapter 4 was symbolic of the rapture. But before we get to the seventh trumpet, we take a huge break and we set up these allegorical characters for the rest of the story. What's really interesting to me is that chapter 12 specifies this is a vision, this is a sign of what's to come, but implies that it is not a literal thing that is happening in front of John. It's more like this part is an allegorical vision about what is to come. And that is the way that the IFB tends to interpret it, reading from chapter 12, verse 1 in the King James. And there appeared a great wonder in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun and the moon under her feet, and upon her head a crown of 12 stars. And she, being with child, cried, travailing in birth and pain to be delivered. So it's pretty clear that that is not literal. Like John is making it, or the Revelator is making it very clear. So a woman clothed with the sun, with the moon under her feet, a crown of 12 stars, is in labor. A great red dragon with 7 heads and 10 horns and 7 crowns is hanging around the woman who is in labor because the dragon wants to eat the child when the child is born. The dragon's tail sweeps a third of the stars out of heaven. This is a reference. The dragon is identified as the devil. So sweeping a third of stars out of heaven is a reference to Lucifer taking one third of the angels with him when he rebelled against God. The woman gives birth, but God takes the child, a little boy who is destined to rule all of the nations with a rod of iron, up to his throne, and the woman flees into the wilderness where God has prepared a safe place for her. John sees a great war in heaven, Michael and the angels fighting against the dragon and his angels. The dragon loses and is thrown out of heaven to become Satan. We talked about this in the Who is Satan episode. The dragon tries to kill the woman who fled to the wilderness, but she is protected miraculously by God. Then the beast rises up out of the sea. The beast is different from the dragon. The beast has, and this beast is the Antichrist, not the false prophet beast. We're getting there. This beast has 7 heads and 10 crowns on 10 horns. So the devil has, hold on.
There's a lot of crowns. There's a lot of horns.
Heads. The devil has 7 heads, 10 horns, and 7 crowns. The beast has 7 heads, 10 crowns, and 10 horns. Is that different?
I don't know.
No, it's the same. It's just different. It's just written differently. Okay. Same amount of heads, but different people. One head seems to be mortally wounded, but that seemingly mortal wound heals. And that convinces people to follow the beast. The beast is not the dragon, Satan, but Satan has given authority to the beast, and the beast will have authority on earth for 3.5 years.
Okay, so the beast can't be a U.S. president because they have authority for 4 years, not 3.5.
Right. Unless they're vice president and the seemingly mortal wound on one of their heads refers to an assassination on the president, and then they are vice president and they appear to be mortally wounded, but then they heal and they take over exactly 6 months into a presidential term.
I'm glad that they've figured out a workaround for that to...
Right. So a second beast rises out of the earth and is buddies with the sea beast. This second beast forces every person to be marked either on the right hand or the forehead with the number of the beast, which is 666. And no one can buy or sell unless they have this mark on their right hand or forehead.
This was familiar to me because we watched A Thief in the Night and we read all those chick comics.
Yeah. And so we're heading into chapter 14 here, and just to like set us within the narrative, we've had 6 seal judgments, and then the 7th seal judgment was all 7 of the trumpet judgments, and we're still on a pretty extended pause between the 6th and 7th trumpet judgments. God sees the Lamb standing on Mount Zion, and with him are the 144,000 who were sealed with God's name on their foreheads. He also fills us in here that the 144,000 are virgins and not liars. Thanks for letting us know. Angels fly overhead giving warnings and prophecies. Then the one like a son of man, or in King James, one like unto the son of man, comes down on a white cloud with a sickle in his hand and reaps the earth. To me, this is the evidence for a mid-trib rapture, because this is around the middle point of the tribulation, when the Antichrist and the false prophet have appeared. To me, this is better evidence for a mid-trib rapture than the verse in chapter 4 is for a pre-trib rapture. And I cannot believe I'm saying that. Watch out for earthquakes in Mobile County, as my dad might be rolling in his grave.
Well, the earthquake in Mobile County might be the earthquake that is prophesied in the book of Revelation as a start of the tribulation.
Yeah, well, if that happens, my dad's going to get resurrected, which would be very cool.
Yeah.
It'll be rad.
Sadie. That would be a great prank for him to pull on you. He would do that. If he got resurrected, he would pull the...
No, he totally would. Anyway. So, the one like a son of man, or one like unto the son of man, comes down on a white cloud with a sickle in his hand and reaps the earth. Another angel comes with a sickle and reaps all of the grape harvest of the earth and throws it into the great winepress of the wrath of God. And the winepress of the wrath of God presses all the grapes in the world, and the blood flows from the winepress as high as a horse's bridle in a river of blood around 184 miles long. I feel like this winepress of God was maybe overlooked in the IFB. I'm going to have to go back and look into that.
You'd think they'd be on Google Maps.
Trying to
find 184 mile long rivers in the area.
Yeah, I think they are. And they're also like on Google Maps trying to find Jesus's touchdown zone for Armageddon. There's definitely something regarding Google Maps and Armageddon. I'll look it up for the next episode.
I did look it up just now. The Jordan River is only 156 miles long. If it had been 184 miles long, then we would have been cooking with gas, but it is only 156 miles long, sadly.
Okay. it said certain number of stadia. 184 miles is a approximation, so it still could be the Jordan River. Let's take up one more offering break. When we get back, we're going to get into the bowl judgments and the end of the story as given in Revelation.
Sounds good.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
We are back from our break. We are talking bowl judgments.
Bowl judgments. The end of the wrath of God.
Whew. Are you sure that there aren't going to be like seven judgments from the seven fortune cookies that are in the seventh bowl?
Not that I know of. Bowl judgments, Armageddon, thousand years, final battle. We can do this. So these are visualized as angels taking bowls full of the wrath of God and pouring them down onto the earth. The first bowl judgment is painful sores for those who do have the mark of the beast on their hand or their forehead. This gets real gross in movies. The second bowl is poured out on the sea. As you may recall, earlier, a third of the sea turned into blood, and a third of the living things in the sea drowned. Now the whole sea turns into blood, and every living thing in the sea dies.
Oh, no.
Not drowned, died. Anyway, the third bowl poured into the rivers, and the rivers become blood. As you may recall, earlier, a third of the rivers became contaminated through wormwood, and now they are all contaminated. It's specified here, they have shed the blood of saints and prophets, and you have given them blood to drink. The point is, God brings absolute justice. Karma is my boyfriend. Karma is a god. Karma is a cat purring on my lap because she loves me. The fourth bowl is poured on the sun, and the sun is allowed to scorch people with fire. People do not repent. A lot of these plagues just sound like climate change.
I don't know, man. I think that the third bowl judgment sounds like St. Patrick's Day because they're dyeing the river green with the blood of leprechauns.
Sure. The fifth bowl is poured on the throat. I'm going to get through this without having another panic attack. I know I can do this.
Sadie triggered herself again.
We're just zooming through. The fifth bowl is poured on the throne of the beast, and the kingdom of the beast goes dark. The followers of the beast curse God, but still do not repent. The sixth bowl is poured out on the Euphrates, and the river dries up. Not that that river was doing anybody any good, because it had been turned into blood, but the Euphrates River needs to dry up for the kings of the nations to meet at Armageddon to have the final battle. Three unclean spirits, like frogs, come out of the mouth of the dragon, the beast, and the false prophet. The three unclean spirits assemble all of the kings of the world at Armageddon. Then we actually get to the seventh bowl. I think whoever wrote this knew how to build tension, because we had, like, we were supposed to have six seals, but then the seventh one was actually, surprise, seven trumpets. And then we were supposed to have seven trumpets, and the last one was kind of a non-deal. And then we actually get the seventh bowl.
I don't know if I'd call it building tension. For me, I feel like we're on season 9 of How I Met Your Mother, and I'm ready for them to wrap.
That's
fair. I just want to see how it ends at this point.
The seventh bowl is poured into the air. A voice from the temple of God in heaven says, "It is done," echoing the last words of Jesus on the cross. The greatest earthquake of all comes. The great city, whatever, wherever that is split into three parts, and 100-pound hailstones rain down on earth. And that's the end of the wrath of God. That's it. That's all he's got. So we get another interlude, kind of like the pause between the sixth and the seventh trumpets. One of the angels who had the seven bowls grabs John, and the two of them are carried away in the spirit to a wilderness to see a different vision. John sees a woman portrayed as a sex worker sitting on a scarlet beast with seven heads and 10 horns. The beast, not the woman. She is dressed beautifully with gold and jewels, and she is holding a golden cup full of her own immorality. A quick TW for swerfy language in the King James. On her forehead is written a name. In King James, it reads, "Mystery Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and abominations of the earth." And she is drunk with the blood of the saints and the martyrs.
Wonder how drunk the saints' blood gets you. Like, what proof do you think it is?
I think that depends on what the saints were drinking recently.
Yeah, well, if John of Patmos is a saint, then my money is on ayahuasca and bath salts.
This woman and then the woman back in chapter 12 who was in labor are huge characters that interpretations tend to center around. Mystery Babylon is very often interpreted to represent either America or the Vatican. And I will get more into that later, but I want to make sure I mention that people who take Revelation literally feel like she's really important. The angel basically, so the angel says to John, "Here, I'm going to give you a super clear interpretation." And then the angel goes off on this interpretation that does not make anything clearer. I'm not going to read all of it, but I'm going to read you a sample of the super clear interpretation that this angel gives. "The beast that you saw was and is not, and is about to rise from the bottomless pit and go to destruction. And the dwellers on earth whose names have not been written in the book of life from the foundation of the world will marvel to see the beast, because it was and is not and is to come. This calls for a mind with wisdom. The seven heads are the seven mountains on which the woman is seated. They are also seven kings, five of whom have fallen. One is, the other has not yet come. And when he does come, he must remain only a little while. As for the beast that was and is not, it is an eighth, but it belongs to the seven, and it goes to destruction."
That doesn't really make things clearer, does it?
No. Parts of this make total sense. Like, the seven heads are the seven mountains on which the woman is seated. The ancient city of Rome was built on seven hills. I really tend to think that's what's being referenced here. People will find a way to make it about either the Vatican or America. Seven kings, five of whom have fallen. One is, the other has not yet come. That seems pretty clear. They're talking about the last five kings of someplace, and then whoever the next guy is going to remain only a little while. And then the last sentence makes absolutely no sense. The only part of the explanation that actually makes things clearer is, well, the woman that you saw is the great city that has dominion over the kings of the earth. That actually helped. And that's why it gets interpreted to be either America or the Vatican so often, because America is, quote unquote, the shining city on a hill, or the Vatican is considered to have authority over kings of the earth.
They don't think that it might be the Roman Empire, which was not only contemporaneous to the writing of this book, but was also responsible for the very recent, as in within the past few decades, destruction of Jerusalem.
Yeah, it also very famously had its capital city built on seven hills.
And also was responsible for the death of Jesus. Definitely. Right. Like, also, though, San Francisco sits on seven hills, so maybe the dragon is the paper dragon that my dad got me from Chinatown when he went to his med school reunion when I was in fifth grade.
Yeah, I mean, as we all know, San Francisco is the capital of the gays, also.
And the deadheads, so I think that John of Patmos would have loved San Francisco.
Okay, fair. So I'm going to go through the last few chapters, I think, fairly quickly here. All of chapter 18 is just basically poetry about the fall of the great city, Babylon. I do want to grab one quote from chapter 18 because it goes into specifics, and that's important to the people who are trying to interpret this literally. Chapter 18, this is verse 11, 12, and 13. "And the merchants of the earth weep and mourn for her, since no one buys their cargo anymore. Cargo of gold, silver, jewels, pearls, fine linen, purple cloth, silk, scarlet cloth, all kinds of scented wood, all kinds of articles of ivory, all kinds of articles of costly wood, bronze, iron, and marble, cinnamon, spice, incense, myrrh, frankincense, wine, oil, fine flour, wheat, cattle and sheep, horses and chariots and slaves, that is, human souls." This great city, Babylon, probably the same as Mystery Babylon the Great, but we're not quite sure, has fallen. The great city is split into three parts by the final earthquake. And what we know about this great city is that it was a big importer of all of these luxury items. Definitely part of the cult of consumerism.
Maybe it was the same city that was importing people from Judea to help build their Colosseum. Importing human souls.
Chapter 19, "The multitudes in heaven celebrate and praise God because God has defeated Babylon and defeated evil forever. The marriage supper of the Lamb takes place." I actually thought there was way more about the marriage supper of the Lamb in Revelation, and there actually is not. So that was surprising to me. At the same time as the marriage supper of the Lamb, Satan is defeated and thrown into the pit and sealed there for 1,000 years. Those who were beheaded for Jesus during the tribulation are raised from the dead and rule over the earth with Jesus for 1,000 years. This is the millennium, this 1,000 years. All premillennialism, postmillennialism, amillennialism spins off from this passage. Premillennialism teaches that this 1,000-year period is literal and will happen directly after the events of the 7-year Great Tribulation. Amillennialism, prefix A meaning no, or amillennialism, teaches that this is not a literal, exact 1,000-year period. It's actually now. It's Jesus reigns on earth because Jesus reigns over the hearts of Christians. And it's not literally 1,000 years, it just means a long time. Postmillennialism teaches that the church will establish the reign of Christ on earth. The world will continue to advance and struggle and get better and better until humanity is perfected and the Great Commission is complete. And then the tribulation will happen, the tribulation is an allegory for Jesus defeating evil forever. But that's how we bring about the end of the world, is by getting better, not by getting worse. After the 1,000 years that may or may not be literally 1,000 years, Satan is released and gets one more chance to deceive people who were, deceive the people on Earth. This is often interpreted as the people who were born during the millennium. Satan and his army march to battle with Jesus and the believers, but fire comes down from heaven and burns them up. And the devil and the beast and the false prophet, devil, antichrist, and false prophet are thrown into the lake of fire forever and ever. Devil is done for. Then the Great White Throne Judgment takes place. This one is another head scratcher for me that I'm going to come back to. All dead people from history stand before the Great White Throne, and books are opened that detail every action that was taken by a person. And the Book of Life is also opened. So it says that the dead are judged by what they did that was written in the books, judged by their actions, but their actions don't have anything to do with the destiny of their soul, because the destiny of their soul is determined by what is written in the Book of Life. King James, whosoever was not found written in the Book of Life was cast into the lake of fire.
So this is very Calvinist, this passage.
It could be interpreted that way, or it could be interpreted as if you didn't accept Jesus, it doesn't matter what you did. In chapter 21, earth and heaven pass away, and God creates a new heaven and a new earth. The new Jerusalem comes down out of heaven, quote, as a bride adorned for her husband. In chapter 19, the church is referred to as the bride of God. In chapter 21, the new Jerusalem is referred to as the bride of God. This is probably two different things. We talked about the new Jerusalem and how it's different from heaven when we did our episode on heaven. I did also notice that there is absolutely no reference to the judgment seat of Christ or Bema seat in Revelation. Those are two names for the judgment only for the saved, where the saved get rewards for their good works. I really thought that would have been in Revelation, but I guess it's not.
It's so wild that it's been so long since you've read this and you're coming back to it and you're like, this is not how I remember it.
Well, I've only read this through like maybe 5 or 10 times, right?
Yeah, but you heard it preached about so much.
I heard it preached so much, so I'm more likely to remember what some pastor said or what somebody's theory was than what is actually in there.
That makes so much sense, though, because how we remember things is so heavily tied to the context in which we heard about them.
So I've read through Revelation conservatively 5 or 10 times. But I've heard it preached about dozens of times, maybe 100 times. So I'm more likely to remember that. Anyway, in chapter 2, there's more description of the New Jerusalem. The river of life flows from the throne of God and the Lamb. And then we have a dialogue between John and an angel who is not Jesus, but is specified to be speaking on behalf of Jesus, and says, "Behold, I am coming soon." This passage repeats several times, "I am coming soon, the time is near, this must soon take place, I am coming soon." And the book finishes up with a warning that if anyone adds to or takes away from Revelation, they will be cursed.
I need to start putting that at the end of every podcast episode, is that if you...
If you say that I said things on the internet, which I did not say, you will be cursed.
Thank you for subscribing to our Patreon. That's not going on the regular edition.
So that's Revelation. I wrote almost all of this episode just directly from having it open in two versions on one side of my screen and typing on the other side of my screen. And I did note a lot of common interpretations, but I think I made that really clear, like what's actually in there and what is not. Next week, it will probably be a two-part episode, so it'll probably be two more episodes. We're going to talk about the IFB interpretation of the Book of Revelation, and find out whether maybe the IFB added a little bit to this prophetic book and should be cursed.
Oh, no. Well, thank you guys so much for tuning into this week's episode. Sorry to everybody who got triggered from it. We hope that this was possibly nice or useful to you to listen to. Aside from that, we're going to be back next week. I think we're going to do an episode with a guest. I don't know who that's going to be yet, but then the next part of the series is going to be the week after that, so that should be good. Hope you guys have a great day. You can follow the podcast on social media at Leaving Eden Podcast. You can follow me at GAVRIELHACOHEN. Sadie, you want to plug your socials?
Yeah, you can follow me on Instagram at Sadie Carpenter Music and on TikTok at Sadie Carpenter 1.
You guys have a great day. Bye-bye.